Hi, this is The Takeaway for Monday, March 6, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Thanks for listening. President Donald Trump is trying again. An order aimed at Muslim-majority countries issued today to restrict people by imposing a new travel ban. The original ban has been stymied and basically nullified by court challenges for nearly a month. The new ban takes effect on March 16th. And then for the next 90 days, immigrants who are not permanent residents of the U.S. from several mostly Muslim countries will be banned from entering the U.S. All refugees will be banned for 120 days, according to the order. Iraq has been taken off the list. The most notable change, a recognition that it is a major U.S. ally in the Middle East. Iraqi officials reportedly also assured Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who announced details of the order today, that Iraq's vetting system was thorough enough to meet Trump administration's standards for so-called extreme vetting. The countries left on the ban are Syria, Libya, Iran, Yemen, Sudan, and Somalia. In the other major change, Syrian refugees, as I mentioned, will be banned for 120 days, but they will be treated like other refugees. The previous order had banned Syrians indefinitely. Here with us to explain this new order and whether it might fare better in a legal challenge is Faiza Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Faiza.
Thanks for having me.
So these travel bans are simultaneously in effect. One is in limbo because of a court challenge. How does this changed order affect its likelihood to withstand legal challenge?
So the order itself revokes the previous order, the one that was enjoined by various courts around the country. So this would be the new framework from the Trump administration for the travel ban. I think that, you know, obviously it has improved somewhat in that people who have been living here for years and are holding green cards will not be affected, as will people who have valid visas for the United States already. But in my view, it's still a Muslim ban, and I think there's a very high likelihood that courts are going to strike this version down as well. And the reason for that is that the Constitution's Establishment Clause prohibits the executive from preferring one religion over another. And the way that courts decide whether or not a facially neutral law, one that doesn't explicitly say, well, we're going to ban Muslims, is in fact unconstitutional, is to look at the purpose behind the law. And the purpose behind this executive order is very clear and always has been. During the campaign, Donald Trump promised again and again to shut down Muslim immigration to the United States, to ban Muslims from coming into the country. And even around the time that the first executive order was signed back in January, people close to him were still making these statements. So I don't think that courts are necessarily going to be taken in by this new revision.
Well, let me interrupt for one second. Does the Ninth Circuit challenge or ruling on the now defunct order, was it largely based on the Establishment Clause, or were there other elements to that order that make this legal challenge fundamentally different?
This legal challenge is fundamentally different. So the Ninth Circuit's decision covered three categories of people. It covered green card holders, and it covered people who currently have visas, as well as the potential class of people who don't have any immigration status in the United States. And the court in that case really focused on the due process rights of people who currently have visas or currently have green cards, but it included this larger group of people within its ruling. Now, it didn't actually rule on the Establishment Clause aspect of it, but it did note serious concerns in that regard.
All right, so these challenges would be a fundamentally new legal argument, but as you say, certainly a plausible legal argument and one likely to find at least some sympathy by the court to take a look at. I want to, because we are limited on time here, do you think this particular order here is something that would have affected the 9/11 terrorists who all had valid visas for coming into the country? In one case, I believe a 10-year multiple entry visa and were largely from Saudi Arabia. Would this ruling have affected people like that?
Well, this order will not affect any of those individuals, right? Because Saudi Arabia is not on the list of countries from which visitors are banned.
So the question of safety really is slightly abstract. How about for immigrants who are taking a look at this order? How concerned should they be about being, put into a vortex of chaos, which was the case a few weeks ago?
Well, the order applies not just to immigrants, but also people who are visiting the United States. So it's important to realize that it's not just immigrants, but a much larger group of people. It seems that this order will be implemented much more systematically. The order itself does not go into effect until the 16th of March, so 10 days from now. And the order lays out in a great amount of detail exactly how different categories of people are going to be affected. So I think that it's certainly better executed than the previous version, but it still remains unconstitutional because it constitutes a religious preference, which is absolutely prohibited by our Constitution.
And that's what the challenge will be if it goes to court. Faiza Patel is co-director of the Brennan Center for Liberty and National Security. Thank you so much, Faiza.
My pleasure.
Also making headlines today, North Korea has fired 4 ballistic missiles. They were fired early today, Korea time. Of the 4 missiles fired just as the annual People's Congress began in Pyongyang, 3 landed in the Sea of Japan, where a very large-scale battle simulation is just getting underway. The U.S., South Korea, and other Pacific allies will game out a battle and an occupation of North Korea in a series of joint exercises that each year provoke the North Koreans to respond symbolically or with military action of some kind. Joel Witt is a senior fellow at the U.S.-Korea Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Mr. Witt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
How much do you think these missile launches are related to the People's Congress in Pyongyang and are just meant as a nationalist exercise? Or do they actually signal something that's coming in a few months in the form of the giant exercises that will be taken by the U.S. and its allies in the Pacific?
Well, the exercises are about to get underway, or some of them have already started, so it's not in a few months. And, you know, I think it was very predictable what the North Koreans would be doing around this time frame, and namely that they were watching and waiting to see what the Trump administration's policies would be and whether it would move ahead with large-scale threatening exercises. And it seems like the administration is moving ahead, and as a result of that, the North Koreans, I believe, will start ratcheting up the tension, and these missile tests may be the first step in that direction.
And do you believe the only counter action that the Trump administration should take is a form of diplomacy as opposed to trying to develop some anti-missile capability, given that it is quite a distance from Pyongyang to the United States?
Well, look, this isn't an either-or question. It's not a question of diplomacy or taking steps to protect ourselves. We should be doing both, and we need to fashion all of our available tools into a strategy to deal with North Korea. So part of that strategy is, of course, diplomacy, trying to see if we can delay or even stop the North Korean programs. But part of that strategy is also other steps, as I said, to protect ourselves, like missile defense, like maybe additional troop deployments to Asia, maybe even considering redeploying tactical nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula. And that's not just to defend ourselves, it's to defend our allies. Don't forget, South Korea and Japan have been treaty allies for decades and are major trading partners of the United States. So we have real security interests in the region, and we need to fashion a strategy to deal with this growing threat.
When you were with the Clinton administration, what was almost achieved there? The Clinton legacy, or at least in the way that he likes to tell it, is that there was a near breakthrough on North Korea, but it just sort of ran out of time. Is that your view?
Well, this is one of the myths that's a problem in fashioning a strategy. The myth is that you can't really conduct diplomacy with the North Koreans. It'll never work. And so why even bother? But the fact is, in the Clinton administration, we reached an agreement in 1994 that basically aborted a North Korean nuclear program that may have produced as many as 100 nuclear weapons by the year 2000. And so that, in my mind, was a big success. So I'm not saying today is the same as 1994, but at least let's try to redeploy the tool of diplomacy and see if we can make some progress.
In looking back on the Cold War, Cuba's threat to the United States has been, you know, savagely overrated. And I think there's an argument that North Korea might be similar to this. Their capacity to destabilize the entire world is fanciful.
Well, yeah, you know, there's always a fine balance between exaggerating the threat and underestimating the threat. But we also have to avoid underestimating the danger. And this has been a serious problem for the past 8 years, because if we were having this conversation 8 years ago, people would have been saying basically, North Korea, small country, they really can't manage to build nuclear weapons or the missiles to deliver them. And now if we fast forward to 8 years later and five more nuclear tests and a lot more missile tests, it's clear the problem is getting worse and worse and worse.
Joel Witt is senior fellow at the U.S. Korea Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A Made in America struggle for union rights in Mississippi, a bitter 13-year attempt to unionize its nearly all-black workforce, came to a head with a demonstration over the weekend by thousands of workers at the Nissan auto plant in Canton, Mississippi. The United Auto Workers Union wants an up or down vote on simply voting on a union, but the company is fighting hard to prevent such a vote. The National Labor Relations Board charged Nissan with violating workers' rights by using intimidation tactics to discourage workers from organizing in any way. Along with Senator Bernie Sanders, activist and actor Danny Glover took to the streets over the weekend. Glover says Nissan has tried to take advantage of the community's original welcome by keeping a large force of temporary workers.
When they opened this plant more than 14 years ago, about 14 years ago, they received about $1 billion in tax incentives from the state of Mississippi. They hired permanent workers, you know, permanent workers with decent wages and a plant that now makes a brand, the Altima, which they sell to urban youth and sell to primarily targeting black buyers and everything else. So it becomes a civil right because the workers have for years, all they demanded is the right to vote on whether they want a union or not. And the company has used every technique from threatening to move the plant, closing the plant, from threatening and intimidating workers, cutting their hours short, and they've been cited by the National Labor Relations Board for those activities. A plant where there's 80% of the workers are black or African American. So those are real issues right here in Mississippi.
What do you say to the charge that there are a lot of workers at this plant in Canton, Mississippi, where, you know, they're concerned that the plant will close? They're concerned that in this economic environment, a union is going to threaten their jobs.
There has to be a place where there's a relationship that the worker has to the company, where workers can be fairly treated and have a voice at the table. And that's what's not happening here at Nissan. All the changes that have happened with respect to benefits, with respect to health care, with respect to safety on the job, are arbitrarily determined by the company itself, not with the discussion with the workers themselves. So I think in the sense that, yes, we came about talk about this economic environment, but Nissan like works with unions around the world. Why is it able to work with unions around the world and not with workers in Mississippi is a question.
What is the record of Nissan on safety and health, according to the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration?
Well, it hasn't been good. They were just cited in February. A worker here had his hand unexpectedly caught in the conveyor belt. And my understanding, I heard that he lost three fingers. There's a worker that died, I believe, last year, who collapsed on the line, and appropriate attention, medical resources necessary for him perhaps to revive him were not available. It took an hour or so for them to be available to him, and he died. So there's a very, very bad safety record here at Nissan. Workers have complained that they're afraid to take any time off for anything. They may be illness or issue. They may have physical issue because they're afraid that they may lose their job or placed in some other situation where the job is difficult, not one that is much easier to accommodate what is happening to them physically. All these are things that this is what would happen if you had a union working on your behalf. Those issues would be on the table in relationship to the company and the workers themselves.
So is it your understanding that workers in Mississippi would want under a union to be able to bargain working conditions and safety conditions and that wages are not really the issue?
Well, wages are not the issue, except the fact you do have workers here, permanent workers who've been here for some years. The plant has been open 14 years, have been here who make more than $26 an hour. They work alongside temporary workers who make up to $10,000 less a year and doing the same work, both doing the work. So the issue around equal work, equal pay is a real issue as well. But this is a plant that began with 100% of the workers were permanent workers. Now 40% of the workers are temporary workers here.
What do workers at the plant say to you about what their hopes are and their fears about even appearing in a march with you?
Well, these are very courageous workers. I've been on this campaign, involved with this campaign for 4 years now. And they're very afraid. I mean, I think the only way we can deal with fear is to acknowledge fear, and they've acknowledged their fear. And so I think that on the one hand, we'd be surprised by the level of support that they receive from the faith-based community and from other groups within the community, as well as the national attention that we hope this campaign will get, because this affects not only Nissan workers. This may be the epic center for the new civil rights issue within the 21st century workers. The same kind of ugly situation will find itself resonating in other industries as well.
Finally, Danny Glover, I mean, right at the beginning of the Trump administration, are you marching into a headwind here?
I hadn't thought about that. You know, one of President Trump's campaign promises that he stood on was workers. And we're talking about fair wages for workers. We talk about the loss of jobs and the potential of losing jobs. And that's always been there. You know, I've been involved with unions for more than 20 years. And I'd like to use saying by Martin Luther King, when Martin Luther King years ago said that the greatest anti-poverty program he knew was a union.
Danny Glover, activist and actor, speaking with us from Mississippi. Thank you so much, Danny.
Okay, thank you, John. All right.
We reached out to Nissan. Brian Brockman, director of group communications from Nissan Group of North America, gave us a statement. Allegations of intimidation made by the union are totally false. Nissan respects and values the Canton workforce, and our history reflects that we recognize the employees' rights to decide for themselves whether or not to have third-party representation. There have been at least 7 confirmed cases of homicides of transgender people in 2017, and in just the last 2 weeks, there have been at least 4 murders of trans women of color. Last year saw the highest on record. Activists say these numbers represent a small piece of the real picture, and they're calling for law enforcement to increase vigilance to prevent and solve these crimes, stop misgendering victims, and for media to do a better job covering these crimes overall. Emily Waters is the senior manager of national research and policy at the New York City Anti-Violence Project. She coordinates a coalition of programs working to end violence against and within LGBTQ communities across the United States.
I think it's really important to put these most recent homicides within the context of what's been happening over the course of the last few years. So we have seen 7 homicides in the beginning of this year, 6 trans women, Black trans women, and 1 Native trans woman. It's hard to know if it's actually a spike or if we're just paying better attention to it and if we're getting better at actually reporting it. We do know that there are lots of other homicides probably happening against the trans community, but because trans victims are so often misgendered and misnamed both in media reports and by police, it makes it really difficult to know the exact number. But what we do hear from people within the trans community and trans activists is that people, have been experiencing really high rates of violence for a really long time. And within the current climate, are definitely more fearful, and they're fearful that that violence is only going to rise.
And what kind of violence are we talking about? A violence that's a direct targeting of trans individuals? Is it a product of circumstances in which the individuals live in that are high violence, high risk circumstances? How do we separate?
You know, we have to kind of look at the entire picture when we're talking about violence against trans people. And in what we find in our reports, so we put out a report every year on hate violence against LGBTQ people as a broader community. And what we find is that LGBTQ people experience violence in everyday places, right? So they're experiencing violence in their housing and in education and in their jobs. On top of kind of this street-based violence that people most often think of when they're thinking of hate violence. You know, if someone doesn't have access to safe education, if someone doesn't have access to safe housing, if people are experiencing kind of transphobia at their work, they're more likely to experience that street-based violence, which places them at higher risk for, physical violence and therefore homicide. And something else that I think is worth noting within kind of the current context climate is that right now, there is kind of this rollback of the very few protections that have existed for trans communities on the national level. And that's a direct kind of reflection of what's been going on for the last, you know, 2-3 years of these anti-trans bills popping up individually in these states.
Is there a precaution, a recommendation that you would have for people to make themselves safer?
I think where we really need to focus our attention is not necessarily telling trans people how to keep themselves safer. Mm-hmm. They know how to keep themselves safe. They've been doing it for a very, very long time. But what we need to be focusing on are, you know, directing our attention to people who are perpetuating violence, and whether that's actually people who are physically violent towards trans people or people who support environments where transphobia exists. Look at your job and look at your school and see how transphobia is playing out there and interject there. That's where we have really the opportunity to actually make trans people safer and help them feel like they have safer and affirming environments for them to exist in.
Emily Waters is Senior Manager of National Research and Policy at the New York City Anti-Violence Project. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Convicted felon Aaron Glasscock looks back on another weekend of freedom on this Monday. All last week in our series, Commuted, Life After Prison, we brought you Aaron's very first taste of freedom when he walked out of prison after 18 years. Back in 1999, the Kentucky native was just 2 months shy of graduating from college when he was sentenced to 30 years in federal prison for a nonviolent drug offense. This past December, Glasscock's sentence was one of more than 1,900 commuted by President Barack Obama. Aaron is currently living in a halfway house in Louisville, Kentucky. He's already told us about his anxiety using public transportation and his nervous deadline, now less than 21 days away, to find a job. Aaron confided to Takeaway producer Dana Roberson that even though he was told all about the many papers he would have to sign as he entered the halfway house, it's still been nerve-wracking.
Oh, wow. I guess I filled paperwork out and watched DVDs for 3 hours or better. To go through all the rules and all the stuff that you have to get done, like business house rules and regulations, things of that nature. Then really it was a waiting game because I couldn't leave here until I got an ID. But before I could even do that, I had to see the counselor. And it took 7 to 10 days, something like that, to see the counselor. So I was stuck in here, not being able to go anywhere, do anything.
Well, what's the living situation like there? Do you have a single room? Do you still have roommates?
There's 6 of us in a room, 2 single beds and then 2 sets of bunk beds. So I'm in the top bunk since I was the most recent to get into the room. There's about 55 to 60 people here all together. I mean, there's hardly no privacy at all, but I'm sort of used to that because, you know, I still get, you know, some alone time. I mean, not alone time, but it's quiet time at least. Not really used to that a whole lot, so that's a plus.
You know, when we were driving in, you were telling me about the list that you had, the list of things that you wanted to do and the things you're not to do list.
Right.
How's that going?
The things I need to do, I've gotten, you know, a job. You know, it's not not a career, because that's what I'm really looking for is a career. But I've got a job. I've got, you know, went shopping, got, you know, some clothes, and got a place to, you know, go to church. Still have, you know, some issues with the what to watch out for, because I want everything done quickly. You know, there's just so many things I want to be able to do, and it's like, you know, I want to do them right now. It's like you're chomping at the bit. So I have to go back and read it every once in a while just to remind me, take a deep breath, don't rush it, because it's not going to happen overnight. So you just got to just be patient and wait for God's time to bring it to you.
So you have a job. Tell me about that.
I'm working at a cabinet-making place here in Louisville. It's about a 15-minute walk. I'm building what they call solid surface countertops, like Corian, marble, granite, stuff like that. They consider that a solid surface.
Do you think you'll have opportunities to look for other jobs, or do they sort of want you to stick with one thing for a while?
Really, it sort of behooves you to, you know, once you get that one job, just sort of to stay there, because everything depends on you working. If you're not working, you're not getting passes to go anywhere. You're basically stuck in the house, and that's as far as you're going. Having a felon already makes it hard to get, you know, a lot of good-paying jobs. Being in here, the halfway house has to call to verify and basically set up a contract with the place that they're going to hire you. They're going to pay you this amount. Your hours are going to be this right here. Your job is going to be this. Every day I go in, I have to call from a phone there saying that I'm there. And when I leave, I have to call from a phone to say I'm on my way back. I get 30 minutes go one way to get from point A to B. And then they want to stop in. They call and talk to your supervisor, you know, at least once a week. So, I mean, it puts a lot on an employer to hire you.
Now that you've been out for a little bit, just sort of walk us through what it's really like and what you think people don't understand or don't know about what you're going through.
I was sort of prepared for what I thought it would be, you know, with my list that we just talked about. And some of those was, you know, just being around people outside of a institutional environment, people that, you know, aren't there to watch you all the time. It's sort of weird how to interact with people, because I still find myself treating everyone that is free with a bit of deferment. You know, I've always been polite, but it's just sort of like, you know, I catch myself, you know, casting my eyes down, you know, looking away from the individual or something like that on occasion. And, you know, I'm adjusting to it. It helps, you know, being at a job. The more that I get out, the more that comfortable I become. I think that there are just a lot of social issues to adjust to. You know, I talked to a guy today, and as you can tell, his mentality is still, you know, inside the prison, but he doesn't recognize it yet. So I think, you know, the recognition is needed in order to be able to address it. And I think that's a lot with a lot of issues, understanding how society has changed if you've been gone for a long time. For instance, with social media, I mean, I haven't been on any of it yet, but it seems like, you know, a lot of people communicate in that avenue instead of calling on the phone and talking. So it's just small stuff like that, just adjusting back to the way that life is on the outside compared to the life on the inside, and how you develop those relationships with individuals. And I still find myself keeping distance from people just out of habit, because what am I going to talk to them about? They don't know my past. They don't know, you know, I don't even know what, you know, people talk about nowadays. What happens if they find out about my past? Well, then will they want to talk to me at all? Things like that, you know, sort of go through your mind.
It'll take a little more time,
yeah.
But you'll get there.
I'm getting there. The more I get out, the more I can socialize with people, the better that I am. And just, you know, you go to work and you come back and, you know, you can get passes to go get your hair cut every other week. You can go to church, but don't really get a whole lot of time so that you can really socialize with people there, you know, to get that interaction.
Aaron Glasscock speaking with Takeaway producer Dana Roberson. We'll check in with Aaron from time to time to see how he's doing. And you can hear Dana Roberson's whole series, Commuted Life After Prison, by going to thetakeaway.org/lifeafterprison. In West Virginia, a generation ago, the girl next door was much more likely to be a blondish, outgoing white girl from a prosperous background in Charleston, a house with a front porch. The boy next door was not likely to be from Pakistan and a practicing Muslim. But a few years back, Amar Ahmed and Anna Sale were prom dates after a friendship that began in the seventh grade. Our series, Uncomfortable Truths, puts people in conversation where they might otherwise not dare to go. And this submission is from Anna Sale, host of the WNYC Studios podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. Anna says she never really understood her friend Amar Ahmed's lifestyles and values, so she sat down with him and had lots of questions. For starters, what was it like to grow up as a person of color in a white rural town? Amar immediately got nostalgic.
I mean, it's funny. Like, I really think of it as kind of the good old days, like the good old days where race didn't seem to matter as much. And so when I think about it, I had instances in which my parent was called the name, like, you know, leaving in the parking lot saying, like, going to go back to your country or something like that. But those are really far and few between. And I really think, like, you just really didn't think about race that much. And I'm actually happy to say that it didn't cross my consciousness that much, like not as much as it seems to be today so prevalent.
In those days, Anna said a noticeable group of her student body was black and about as many were South Asians. And despite her friendship with Amar Ahmed, she had different views of these different minorities, views that she still doesn't fully understand today.
This is, like, really embarrassing to say out loud, but I can remember having a realization in junior high, like looking around in Latin class and realizing that the South Asian kids who were in the class weren't white, and it blowing my mind, like that they didn't have that default identity, which is so, it speaks a lot, I think, to how I always saw the black kids in our school as not being white, but the South Asian kids, it took me realizing, like, oh, they don't walk through the world as a white person like I do. Do you remember what I got you for your 18th birthday?
I'm blanking.
So I got you, I put together this like 18-year-old kit, and it was all these things that you could have now that you were 18.
Ah, yes, I do remember. Yeah.
The two things that I remember getting since I was 18, I was able to purchase them. I got you either cigarettes or cigars, and I put it in the kit. And the other thing, because I worked at the bookstore in town, you know, that was like the artsy bookstore. And so I was like, I have to get him some pornography because that's what you can buy when you're 18. But the only pornography that the bookstore sold was this lesbian porn magazine. So I got you a lesbian porn magazine.
I do remember that.
I like look back at that and I'm like, was that horribly insensitive to, like, give that to my friend who's an observant Muslim and, like, to give him the lesbian porn? Like, how do you feel about that?
You know, it's funny. Like, I think, you know, even amongst devout Muslims out there, there's many that aren't devout, but, you know, I would consider myself, you know, practicing. I think everybody's got a little bit, there's varying degrees, but there's a little bit of living parallel lives. So no, I thought it was fun. I thought it was a hilarious present. I thought it was very thoughtful.
Did you feel a change after 9/11, how you were just treated going about your daily life?
A little bit. I mean, I have tons of friends and my wife has tons of friends on Facebook, for example, that specifically, like, very insulting things have, you know, been said to them by strangers, by literal strangers. Things like people, you know, telling them that, you know, take that rag off your head, you know, you live in the United States now and things like that. And so, you know, it's just really insulting. And so I just feel like there's a lot of that these days. And again, it hasn't affected as much me directly, but definitely friends and friends of friends, like, quite a bit. You know, in the last year, I mean, you know, there's weird stuff going on politically and everything. I mean, have you noticed either temporal difference then versus now versus just, like, you know, a small town kind of West Virginia difference versus kind of big cities? What's been your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know, it's kind of comforting to hear that the way that you remember high school being just a time when, like, feeling innocent and like warm. That's how I remember it. And because I'm like, was I missing things because I was white and just wasn't paying attention to what other people were going through who weren't white, who I considered close friends, you know? I certainly think that if we asked someone who was a black kid at our high school, they would have a very different thing to say about what it was like to go to our school.
Yep, definitely. I think absolutely. Yeah. Why do you think that is? 'Cause I think I know maybe, but why do you think that is?
I think it was partially, I mean, I can remember there was a lot of identity around class at our high school. And so I think the white kids who were from basically the haulers that went to our high school, there was an identity around owning that sense of like, I'm not from these fancy neighborhoods, but I still go to this fancy public high school. And I can remember like someone flying, like waving a Confederate flag on a hill in front of our high school as sort of a like redneck pride kind of thing. And that's very racialized, you know, and that's threatening to African-American students. I think the South Asian kids who were in my class were in my classes, were in my honors classes. I can remember it wasn't until college looking around a seminar table and realizing this is the first time that I've been in the same classroom with an African-American student. And I don't know what the reason for that was in our high school.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, South Asians, it just wasn't, you know, we weren't really on the radar. You know, again, there wasn't that many of us. And I'll give you an example. Like, this was actually one of the very few times where actually there was like hostility or something negative, right? So this happened. I don't know if you remember, but it was student council. We had this competition, and I think the winning class, like 10th, 11th, 12th, got a steak lunch or something catered by Dr. Lowen or like Mr. Lowen, like the principal. And at that time, like somehow, I don't even remember if we were the winning class, but somehow I was in the role of like giving out tickets for this steak dinner. And I remember that like a not to be named individual, like this big fellow like in who was a year above me, he was like walking towards that where they were serving the steak dinner, and I was handing him my ticket, and he took the ticket and he looked at me, he had this quizzical look on his face, and he said, "You's a fuzzy little fella, ain't you?" Like, I don't know if I don't think he even responded. And then he was like, "Yeah, he's a fuzzy little fella from overseas." Yeah, he said, "But that's cool. Like, that's cool." Yeah. And so then, yeah, I just gave him his ticket, and he just kind of, you know, went and got his steak. Yeah. And so like, there was, you know, every now and again there was a little something that, like, "Hey, I'm different." Like, you know, there's an odd little interaction, but it was, you know, it was so benign, and it was so occasional.
Oh, Amar, this makes me want to hang out with you more. I feel like we're right in the same room. Amar, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Anna Sale is the host of the WNYC Studios podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. We want to hear from you, and we want you to participate. Visit thetakeaway.org and tell us who you'd like to have a difficult talk about race with. Could be a friend, a family member, a coworker. Next week in this series, Virginia Young, a reporter for WESA in Pittsburgh, talks with two members of the African-American community in that city. It's a conversation between a longtime resident watching her neighbors get pushed out by gentrification and a newcomer reflecting on how he benefits from those same changes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.